She reduces, reuses, and recycles. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
We have a really exciting guest. She's actually at a rally in New York City today. Her name is Dr. Sandra Steingraber, and she is the author of an incredible book called Raising Elijah. I have wanted to have Sandra on the show for almost a year. You are indeed listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think, we just want you to. We have made contact with Sandra, and she is live from New York, and it's not Saturday night. So, Sandra, hi, how are you?
Hi, thanks for your patience. Here I am.
Okay, it all works, and the show does go on. I'm so happy that you took the time to be a part of the show today. As you know, I've been wanting to have you on for over a year, and we finally made it happen. Let's talk about, I just have to do a couple of quick announcements, and then we'll get right into the show. This is the, You're one of the first guests that I ever had where I came up with three pages of questions that were like stream of consciousness, so we won't have any trouble with content. Please remember to join me every Saturday live at noon Arizona time at MrsGreensWorld.com. I'd like to also remind you that you can listen on your iPhone or Droid because we are modern. All podcasts are up on my website, usually within about a day, right there for your listening pleasure. The best way to stay in contact with me is, of course, via the social media networks, Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest. If you have questions, email me at mrsgreensworld.com. And this is the point of the show where I do a shout out for one of our sponsors. It's a company called EcoBella. And once again, it always seems to me, because of the quality of the guests I have and the quality of the sponsorships that I have and partners, this company is so strongly in alignment with the message that our guests today will be sharing with us, the dangers of toxins in our environment. EcoBella's founder, Sally Malanga, started the company to provide cruelty-free organic cosmetics and natural skincare products. And the effort grew to include products actually derived from organics. She cares about the sourcing of the products. And for me, I find it very liberating, even with the minimal amount of skincare products that I use, that I don't have to worry about what I'm putting on my body, where the products were sourced, or that there were some fair trade violation. They are in complete alignment with my mission to preserve our planet and protect its animals. So please check them out by visiting EcoBella. It's with two C's, EcoBella.com, and be a part of the growing number of conscious consumers who support companies that take sustainability and corporate stewardship for the planet seriously. I cannot emphasize that enough, how important that is. So, Sandra, it's funny. I looked at some of your YouTube videos, and some say it's Sandra, and some say it's Sandra. So you say tomato.
It all depends on where you're from.
It is, and I'm from Jersey, so I definitely would say Sandra. One thing that I do want to do is a proper introduction, which could take about 15 minutes, and I'm not trying to just, you know, pump up the volume here, but Sandra Steingraber is an environmentalist. She's an author. She's an ecologist. She's a cancer survivor. And I think what resonated the most with me and what stood out the most is she really and truly writes, not only from the perspective of a scientist, but that of a mother. So to me, her message is pure. It's the place from which she comes. And I am going to fire away questions for you because it's your book, Raising Elijah, was one of those that every consciously living parent wants to turn the page because your books, your activism, and your message to the global community is so important and so on purpose. I'm using a lot of so's, but safeguarding our children, it's the most compelling and most powerful issue that we can get behind. So let's start. That's enough about that. I've used up 5 minutes of your time just doing the glowing reports. Can we start with the book? Because I would like to eventually get to what you're doing in New York and the very controversial issue of fracking. So is that okay? Let's start because you say things in your book that I believe, that our children face an environment more threatening to their health than any generation in history. So let's talk about a little bit about your background. Your dad was exposed to DDT. I mean, you come from a cancer survivor perspective. What was the background that got you to be the biologist, the ecologist, the activist that you are today?
Sure. Well, I guess that story really starts with my own mom, and she was a biologist before me. I'm adopted, and so the deal was in 1959, I'm now 53 years old, when you adopted a child, you kind of had to agree to become a stay-at-home mom. So for my mom, who had been the first in her family to go off to college, she came from a farm background, one of six kids, to have to give all that up to in exchange for motherhood was a decision that happily, you know, women, including me and later generations, didn't have to make. So the consequence, the happy consequence for me was I had a microscope by the time I was nine, and my very first memory of my mom and me together is cracking open fossils on our front stoop. So my mom really introduced me to the joy of biology, which I see as a field of study that's about the mystery of being alive. Right, and biologists want to solve that mystery. And I think as an adopted person studying especially ecology, you know, I'm part of that generation where adoption was very much surrounded in secrecy and shame, and so I don't have access to my biological ancestry or even the story of my own birth. And so biology offered me a much larger tree of life, if you will, to see as my roots. So it plays a very large role in my life. And then my mom and I both became cancer patients at the same time. She was diagnosed with metastatic breast cancer in her mid-40s, and then I, shortly thereafter, at age 20, was diagnosed with bladder cancer. And my aunt went on to die of the same kind of bladder cancer that I had. But I knew that we were not related by chromosomes. Or I wasn't related to my family by chromosomes. So I became very interested very early on as a young biologist in what families have in common besides genes, and very often they are the environment. So that became my life's work. Instead of going on to medical school, I studied environmental health. I've now ended up writing a trilogy of books on environmental health, of which Raising Elijah is the last one. And happily, after becoming a cancer patient at 20, I became a mother at the brink of 40, which I know most of my readers' wives are not.
Which is a big life change.
Right. And so I, after writing about carcinogens, I then turned my attention in my most recent two books on the ways in which developmental toxicants can enter the story of prenatal development and child development and even sexual maturation in our teenagers and alter the way our children's bodies are getting constructed. So this is a new threat to parenthood that we parents, because it's our job to keep our children safe and plan for their future, we can't turn away from these threats. We have to learn about them and then take some kind of action to protect our children from harm. So I hope Raising Elijah, which is written, as you say, both out of my voice as a mother and a biologist, helps other parents, you know, figure out where they want to insert themselves into this really big conversation in our whole nation right now, which is how to create a sustainable economy.
And the whole global community. I mean, to me, it's like
exactly.
we just live in a global community now. Don't call it the United States or Canada, but yes,
yep.
But what you're writing about is certainly, you know, the wind blows across the boundaries, and we certainly saw that with the last, you know, tsunami and all those things where the rubbish ends up in Hawaii in a couple of months. So there is a great deal of science in the book, and yet you tell a delightful story, and sometimes those two can be mutually exclusive. It's like, oh my God, I can't read three pages of this. You weave in stories that are real-life stories, and I think it's great for our listeners to bring it down to ground zero. The story of you and your husband looking for the right nursery school for Faith and what happened there, because to me it's really... it's reflective and a metaphor for so many things being ignored in our world. It's like to know better is to do better. Well, not really all the time.
Right, so right. Well, I did put that story right near the front of the book because I wanted, it is a kind of microcosm, I think. So So essentially what happened is another biologist mother and I discovered that the play structure in our nursery school was made out of pressure-treated wood, which at the time our daughters were in nursery school. The EPA, there was a lot of attention about pressure-treated wood because the EPA had just decided that the risk for cancer to children playing on those play structures was so great, it was now going to prohibit the residential sale of what's called CCA wood, this chromated arsenic wood, and it was being pulled off the market. So it was in the headlines every day, and we knew we had such a structure. And so another biologist mom and I, who knew all the kind of protocols for chemical testing, took soil samples and swipe samples and took them into an analytical chemical lab, and they came back really shocking. So that we had, you know, arsenic levels in the soil that our kids were making mud pies from that were 17 times what would be allowed at as a Superfund cleanup site. We knew that arsenic was leaching from the rails onto our children's hands and so forth. And so everyone, the story I tell is the way in which all these parents and teachers were united initially around this data and were determined to solve this problem until we realized there was no easy solution. Putting our, you know, just deconstructing this play structure and putting it in a hazardous waste landfill would cost upwards of like $10,000 to $15,000. No bake sale could raise that amount of money.
So that's a lot of organic brownies.
Right. And so, and of course, then the board of the community center wasn't interested in helping us. And once we realized there was no easy solution, what happened was, one by one, parents started to turn away from the data and rationalize it and decided, well, maybe it wasn't as bad as it sounded.
It's only arsenic. Then, I mean, how does that work? It's
arsenic,
only
right?
Arsenic.
A known carcinogen, which I call in the book, you know, the Osama bin Laden of toxic
yes,
chemicals.
Yes, you right? did, and I remember that line. I'm sure I underlined it.
Well, arsenic is not a lot worse than arsenic. I mean, it's not only a known carcinogen, but it also interferes with our hormones, so it's hormonally active. And children have a special sensitivity to it because they don't have the same enzymes that we do to break it apart. So when arsenic gets in the body of a child, it actually lasts longer. They don't pee it out as fast as we adults. And furthermore, you know, children have these unusual behaviors that kids do that adults don't do. For example, let's see if I have this fact still memorized. The average four-year-old puts his or her hands in her mouth an average of 9.4 times per minute, with an average of 2.5 fingers inserted in the mouth with each mouth-hand interaction. So there are actually data on this. And so, you know, kids put their hands in their mouth. And so when they're playing on a play structure and it's raining and the arsenic is leaching out, you know, it's not like an adult who's walking around in that play structure. I actually saw a kid take their chewing gum out of their mouth, stick it on the railing of the arsenic-treated playground, eat a sandwich, and then put the chewing gum back in his mouth. I mean, that's what kids do.
That's what kids do.
And that's why we don't surround them with arsenic, right?
And there's a part of that where it's like that.
There's arsenic in the environment. There's arsenic inside the kid. That's
right.
Just
that's what the kid should be allowed to do. Like, I was
right.
never afraid of making mud pies or watching my kids do it, so kids should be allowed to do it. So go ahead. The story is, to me, rather devastating.
Well, the story leads me into, well, it all ends very badly, right? Eventually, parents tell their kids not to play with my kid and all this kind of stuff, and so we had to switch nursery schools. But the story is a leaping off point for Raising Elijah because I think it, touches on this place where a lot of well-meaning parents find themselves, which is a phenomenon that psychologists actually have a name for called well-informed futility syndrome.
Oh, my
right?
gosh. I'm going to write that down.
Which means that if you learn about a problem that you can't solve, you just feel futilely well-informed. And that evokes in us such feelings of guilt, because once you know something, you feel like you have to protect your child against it. But if you can't figure out how to do that, and then the only solution is something really inconvenient, like pulling them out of the nursery school, then you rationalize away the danger, right? And so I think that's a place where a lot of parents find themselves. And so the rest of the book then represents my attempt as a mom, as a biologist, to march my readers out of that bad place and have some agency over the situation. And in a lot of cases, that agency is not attainable through individual consumer action on our own. It has to be done through political action. Certain things simply have to be redesigned so they're no longer toxic, so that we busy parents no longer have to worry about them. So the question is, how can we do that? And I hope I provide some answers. And that leads me to the title of the book. Raising Elijah is really, obviously my son's name is Elijah. He's now 11 years old. And I'm speaking to you from a Baptist church in Painted Post, New York, which is in the bullseye of the target for fracking, which we can talk about in a minute. And outside these doors is a rally full of parents, and that's where my real-life son Elijah is right now, holding up a sign against fracking, to try to protect this community here from a demonstrable danger. So part of the story of raising Elijah is me really raising this kid named Elijah, but his namesake is the other half of this title. He was named for an abolitionist from my home state of Illinois, Elijah Lovejoy. And so raising Elijah is meant to evoke that Elijah and raise up the spirit of Elijah Lovejoy for our age now. In 1837, when Elijah Lovejoy was fighting slavery, our economy of the day in the United States was so dependent on slavery that it was considered absolutely, you know, a pie-in-the-sky, impossible, extreme idea to emancipate slaves and have immediate abolition. And in fact, we took a kind of regulatory approach to slavery. It was thought to be so entrenched, and it was so much personal wealth was bound up in it, that the only thing we could do was do things like the Missouri Compromise, right, where Missouri would be a slave state, but Maine would be a free state, and then we had laws about returning slaves, and we stopped new slaves from coming over to Africa, and we tried to, like, regulate it. And it just kept getting worse and worse, and eventually we had to take the decision that we had to redesign our economy so it was no longer dependent on slave labor. But Elijah Lovejoy was assassinated in the free state of Illinois, not far from where I grew up, for daring to say that no matter how dependent our economy was on slave labor and no matter how much economic benefit we accrued from it as a nation, which included, you know, not only slave owners, but people who bought things like sugar and cotton because the cost of goods were lower. He said that no matter that, there's a more fundamental thing at stake here, and it's just a homicidal abomination, and it needed to stop. So I'm trying to raise up the spirit of abolitionism for our time right now, which is a time when we are pursuing pathways of energy independence that rely on very dangerous, very toxic, extreme forms of fossil fuel extraction, and saying that I don't care how important it is to get that gas and oil out of the ground, it's a homicidal abomination. We're killing our kids and we're killing the planet. We need a radical redesign of our nation's energy systems, and this is my job as a parent, because when you live in a place, as I do, on top of the shale, which is a target for the oil and gas industry, they will ruin the environment that your child depends on in order to get at the hydrocarbons, and that has to stop.
And I've, you know, I tell the story on the show. I interviewed a woman, I'm sure you know her, Winona Howder from Food and Water Watch. And, you know, Sandra, I took the day off after I interviewed her. I couldn't interact with people because the things that she shared, even though I thought I was very aware up on an amateur scientist on fracking, she was still able to shock me. So when I was preparing for the show, and I've been preparing it in my head for weeks, I loved the book Raising Elijah. I think it should be required reading for every parent. And I don't say that lightly, because people listening can tell that you are telling your very personal story from your heart of when you knew you were pregnant and on and on. So the show can go either way. I want you to share some of the fun stories. You have to share the kale story when we have, because I've told lots of girlfriends that there's a story about Mrs. Green and kale saying, I will never put that in my mouth. And of course, now I had a smoothie with kale this morning. So don't ever say never. But let's, I don't want to get in a big topic of discussion. I have a really great board op who gives me the signal and says, you always start a great conversation before the break. So let's just do a recap. I think I have about a minute before we go to the break, and say again for people that might have just tuned in, who you are, Sandra Steingraber is the author of numerous books and articles. You're a prolific writer, an informative writer, an engaging writer. She is a mother, author, ecologist, and cancer survivor. I want to also say, and I don't do this to embarrass you, but to give credibility to all that you are doing, an internationally recognized authority on the environment and the links to cancer and human health. High-profile leader, actively. Can I catch you on any TV station today? That's what I want to know. Can I go on the internet?
I think Fox News. I just did an interview with Fox News in Binghamton, New York, earlier today. So probably there's something coming out this evening.
And, you know, I've been to Binghamton. When I read about what you're doing around that area, I know it quite well. Our parents used to take us on vacation to the Adirondacks and to the Poconos, and that was our, stay in a log cabin. So please stay here with me. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. We don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. And our wonderful guest today, Sandra Steingraber, is giving us lots to think about. Please stay here with me. We'll be right back.
Can you predict the future? The reality is we can't, but we can be ready for it. Funded by the National Science Foundation, researchers at the University of Arizona are working on a $3 million project to study the monsoon and learn about our changing desert weather, climate, and ecology. Such knowledge will help guide us to a more sustainable future, not just for our desert, but for the world. Now that's thinking ahead. The University of Arizona. Big questions, bold solutions, better tomorrows.
Hi, I'm Abbott Taylor. With over 35 years creating jewelry in Tucson, no one has more experience in designing and making diamond jewelry in Tucson than Abbott Taylor Jewelers. Please come in and see some of the thousands of designs we have created, or come in and have us design something original just for you. Whether you're looking for a simple and stylish graduation gift, your engagement ring, or a breathtaking jewelry piece to celebrate an important birthday or anniversary, you can't beat our competitive diamond pricing. With 100% trade-up guaranteed, set in an Abbott Taylor jewelry design, always using earth-friendly recycled gold. Abbott Taylor Jewelers, exquisite jewelry designs and exceptional diamond deals created right here in Tucson for over 35 years. Abbott Taylor Jewelers at 6383 East Grant Road, on Facebook and on the web at atdiamonds.com. Diamond designs for everyone. Abbott Taylor Jewelers.
Hi, this is Mrs. Green with some great news about the all-new 2012 VW Passat. It's 2012 Motor Trend Car of the Year, best in class for legroom, and has standard Bluetooth technology. VW thought of everything by giving the Passat a brand new sleek design that conveys confidence and assertiveness. If you're looking for the best ownership experience possible and a great new Passat, visit Chapman Tucson at 4600 East 22nd Street between Columbus and Swan.
You can always find things around the house to give to Goodwill. But I have a bigger reason to give. My brother, Jim. When Jim was just 6 weeks old, he had a stroke. He had to rewire his brain to do most things we all take for granted. Thanks to Goodwill, Jim has a job and a sense of purpose. You know how they say your donation to Goodwill changes lives? Well, it's true. Goodwill is the best thing that ever happened to Jim. Please donate today.
Habitat for Humanity's Habit Store is changing the world. By selling new and used building and home improvement materials to the public, the Habit Store is diverting more than 250 tons from the landfill each year. To donate, call 520-889-7200. Stop by and shop today. The Habit Store is located at 935 West Grant Road. Proceeds from all the sales go to Habitat for Humanity Tucson. For more information, go to habitattucson.org or call 520-889-7200.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to, and we are giving you lots of really interesting things to think about today. I certainly give my personal plea for all of our listeners to really think about what our guest, Dr. Sandra Steingraber, is talking about. She is a mother, author, ecologist. I mean, it's like dot, dot, dot. very, very important person on the planet with a big purpose and a big yes that she said to help us make the world a better place. I want to mention that the show today is sponsored in part by Goodwill Industries of Southern Arizona, another proud partner of Mrs. Green, and certainly doing their part to make a difference for the planet with all of the at-risk populations that they hire through my purchases of repurposed items at Goodwill. So proud of that partnership, and also that we are a part of the Dream Vision 7 radio network. My show re-airs every Monday and Tuesday on that network, and you can pick it up by accessing their website at dreamvision7radio.com. Sandra, again, thank you so much for being on the scene and on my radio show today. Little did we know. So can we go back to the kale story? And one of the reasons I think it's so important is that let's start with, in my opinion, the way that you raised your children and their conversations around eating was very important one to share today, because I was labeled as a picky eater almost at birth, and it's something that embarrasses me in public at times. You know, I'm allergic to fish and don't put asparagus on my plate, and on and on. And I'm working to overcome that because of this journey. But you, and I don't blame my mother. I loved my mother. She planted the seeds in me too. I think I was born a pill. But talk to us, share with us the story of how you and your husband decided to begin the conversations around food with your kids, who it seems eat everything.
I do have two good eaters, and I tried to put a lot of funny stories in Raising Elijah.
And you did.
To help readers through some of the dark parts of the book. And, you know, there's nothing worse than trying to be funny and failing. So this is my first attempt to really be comedic in tone. So
it worked. I've told the kale story lots of times. I said her child was screaming for kale in the story.
So I had a child who threw a temper tantrum in the middle of the supermarket because I would not buy him kale. And so it's many people gathered to see a three-year-old throwing a full operatic tantrum in the, you know, the dairy aisle because he wanted kale and I had said no. So how did that happen? Well, it all actually began with another funny story about my husband and my television set being stolen out of the back of our moving van when we moved from Boston to New York.
Loved that story too. Laughed out loud.
And so therefore, we never replaced it, and we never had a television, so our kids never got advertised to. And then it was became my husband's job to do the grocery shopping, and he discovered it was far more convenient to go to the food co-op because he didn't have to read all the damn labels, right?
Right.
Everything was healthy and organic.
It's like my skincare. Just put it on.
Right. I mean, you know, when you have a 2-year-old and a 5-year-old in the cart and somebody's late for their nap, speed is the solution. You have to get through the aisles. You can't stop and read labels. So he would just, like, fly through the aisles and dump everything into the cart, knowing it's the food co-op, it's organic anyway. And then, of course, what really sealed the deal was there was a play area in the co-op, and my husband could sit there and drink much-needed cups of coffee and read the art section of the New York Times while the kids played. So all our shopping, therefore, was done at the co-op, but, of course, it's expensive, so how could we afford it? Well, he ended up working 2 hours a week there, and we got a discount. Right, and that still, he argued, was faster and more convenient, even with the time spent volunteering as a worker, than trying to comparison shop and fly all around 2 or 3 different other grocery stores with kids in tow. So this was set the stage for our kids never having been advertised to by the food industry. No television at home, and they only went to the food co-op. They'd never been in, like, a regular supermarket where, you know, superheroes stare out at them at pediatric eye level trying to sell
right.
them junk food.
Right.
Right? So therefore, their taste preferences developed along the line of whatever was most colorful and interesting in texture. So they love red bell peppers, and then my son developed this fixation on kale, and that led to this so-called temper tantrum.
I loved it. I loved it. And people said kale, not candy. And I'm like, no, it was kale. I had to go
it
back and reread
kale.
It because he wanted kale. And I wanted to ask while I was reading the book, tell everybody why you didn't get it for him. What you had told
the
kids.
I had told the kids we were only going in for shampoo and not asking me for any treats. And for Elijah, a treat was kale. And when he saw that it was on sale at the deli, you know, behind the glass, it was all all too much for him. And I guess the sort of analog or the corollary story to that one was when my kids actually went to McDonald's for the first time, which happened in the O'Hare airport when I ran out of food and our flight was delayed.
Loved that story too.
Handed them each a little, you know, red and yellow sack of food, and they opened it up and both burst into tears. My son, because the food was too brown, he was used to colorful food, brown bun, brown hamburger, brown Coke, brown meat, and he didn't want to eat brown. My daughter looked up at the golden arches, which nobody had told her were golden arches, right? And she said, "Mom, I'm not going to eat their food. Look at that. It's a limp French fry." And she thought the golden arches were like two yellow French fries bent over, and that was just gross to her. So there you go.
Right. And I like it. You know, I love the tagline for our show, "We don't tell you what to think. We just want you to." And a lot of what your book is, going back to something you mentioned earlier, is it's not, you didn't say it as though overcoming objections, but as I was reading it, you were overcoming some of mine. Okay, here's an example. You are all those things that I said, busy, active, out there, two kids, husband who's an artist, and you travel and cook 365 days a year. At least that's what it said somewhere when I read about you. Is that true?
It's true. And here's where, I hope the book isn't self-righteous, but I am really proud of
it. It absolutely is not at all. It's just like, wow.
I mean, I really messed up my kids' bedtime schedule. I mean, there's a lot of things you see in the book that I just did wrong. But I am pretty proud of the food thing. And it turns out, and I know this is only a sample size of two, my daughter and my son, but it turns out that for me, cooking good and healthy food sourced locally, no television, and serving the food and saying, you know, this is what we all eat. I don't cook pediatric meals. Everybody eats the same stuff. This is dinner. You don't have to eat it, but then the kitchen's closed or things. So my basic philosophy is I breastfeed them as long as they want breast milk, and then I stick a spoon in their hand and say, "Here's what food looks like. Here you go."
Because I like
I'm
that.
A busy working mother, right? I mean,
right.
And also, as a mammal, I mean, I study mammal. I'm a mammalogist by training. I know that the reason mammals inherited the earth is because we didn't have to feed our juvenile offspring special foods. That's the advantage of being a mammal, unlike amphibians or fish or reptiles that are always having, or birds, always having to go seek out special food for their infants that's different than adult food. That is actually really labor-intensive, and that prevents, let's say, reptiles from living in the Arctic. But mammals can live in the Arctic because we can walk around with milk in our own bodies at the right temperature that's sterile and feed our kids anytime we want until they're old enough to eat the food that we eat. So I basically followed the philosophy of all the other mammals. That became my parenting philosophy, and I do. I mean, I work full-time. I travel 150 days of the year. But, you know, there are things like chest freezers and crock pots, and so a little effort in the month of September, and Monday is going to be my day to can tomatoes on Monday, and I hope to get more than 50 jars done. And that will be fast food in January. I just crack one open, throw it in the crock pot, put some beans in there, push the button at 3:30 in the morning, and then I can go to the airport and fly off to a lecture three time zones away, knowing that my kids are going to come home to a healthy meal that night. And just the idea that I know what they're eating helps connect me to them as their mother and make me feel that I'm somehow still present, even though I might be 3,000 miles away. So it's not like my husband can't cook. I want to be clear about that. I'm actually kind of controlling about food in the kitchen because I need to feel like I'm still on the job even when I'm not there.
And it's just, I don't know, that part really struck me. And I want to say over and over and over, there is nothing righteous about your book. I didn't feel preached to. I didn't feel judged. I felt inspired. I felt like some of my own personal objections could be overcome. And I'm 61, a work in progress. But I would like to talk about a little bit, it's a little bit touchier, but I think it's very confusing to me. And I talk about it with my husband all the time about, we'd like to believe that the government has our backs, which is kind of laughable at times. I have to say that. I try not to make the show political. But reflective of that, you had a story in the book about the strawberries and methyl bromide. And we were interviewing a guest in a couple of weeks from the NRDC, and I've been talking to her. And to me, when in an organization that I pay for as a taxpayer, like the FDA or, you know, agriculture, whatever, USDA, they know what they were doing about the strawberries and the methyl bromide, and they fought to allow it. So can you just elaborate that on that a little bit, give the science of that? And the and to me, it was horrific. It was just like,
okay, sure.
It was appalling.
Yeah. Well, so there's, you know, let me just kind of preface this by saying that after World War II, all these chemicals came on the marketplace, a lot of which had been developed in the secrecy of wartime. DDT was one that was used to wipe out a typhus epidemic in Italy. My father actually fought in Italy, so I'm glad my father didn't die in a typhus epidemic. But so these chemicals were developed very quickly, and there was no time to test them for safety. And then after the war was over, we didn't want our economy to slip back into depression, so, and we had all these stockpiles of chemicals left, so they were just rolled out and became, and new purposes were found for them. So DDT had a disease destroying purpose, and then it ended up being used, you know, under the kitchen table, under the kitchen sink for pest control right in people's homes.
For raid.
And so, right. And so methyl bromide kind of fits into that larger story of chemicals that were rolled out without any advanced testing for safety. And then when our federal agencies kind of in the 70s realized that there was this uncontrolled, toxic, undefined problem on their hand, they had a big game of catch-up to play. And we're always and continue to be in not being on top of the situation. So methyl bromide is special in a way that few other pesticides are. It's used for strawberries and tomatoes to keep pests out of the field. It's a sterilant, so basically just kills everything off. And it rises into, it evaporates and rises up into the atmosphere and destroys the ozone. So even though we're using it, you know, at the surface of the ground, the really bad effect that it has is to destroy the ozone layer that our children and all of us depend on to filter out cancer-causing ultraviolet rays. And we know that the ozone hole is a big public health menace. And so the rest of the world has phased out methyl bromide because it's considered an inherently dangerous, unmanageable substance. However, the United States petitioned to have an exception to that prohibition because it said that our strawberry farmers and our tomato growers had no other substitute. So it claimed that there was this economic necessity. Now, how the rest of the world's farmers know how to grow strawberries and tomatoes without methyl bromide, and somehow in the United States our farmers don't know that, I don't get that.
I don't get that either. It doesn't hold up. It just doesn't hold up.
That's not the angle I take in raising Elijah. What I'm really interested in is, how can I, as a mother, direct my food dollars toward purchases that don't erode the ozone layer in a way that causes my kids problems? In other words, I want the pizza sauce on my kids' pizza to be in line with my attempts to keep their hats on at the beach. I don't want those things to be at war with each other.
Right, right.
So, yeah, and because mothers buy most of the ingredients for food, and we in most households control the food dollars. Actually, not in mine. My husband does that in my household. So my message is to other moms about how, since we have to feed our kids anyway, how can we redirect our food dollars toward farmers who aren't spraying chemicals that are threatening to destroy the whole global ecosystem for that our kids depend upon, and not go broke at the same time. So I have a fairly frugal food budget, and I think at the time I wrote it, it was $140 a week. It's a little more now because my kids are older and, of course, they have to eat more.
Right.
So I try to lay out in the book, like, how I manage to stay on my budget and feed my kids the kind of foods that are grown with the values that I believe in, and I can teach them that this is what our family believes, and we're proud of that. These are our values. So, you know, there are some recipes in the book. There's my food budget. So I kind of lay everything out as model or maybe counter model for my readers.
And it's life-saving. I mean, to me, it's life-saving. And we have 2 minutes before the break. I want to ask you this, and I probably should ask you after the break, what about endocrine disruptors for girls? It seems to me that it's worse. We are so hormone-driven. You know, we are the ones that have the children. We're the ones that breastfeed. The whole balance seems to me to weigh in favor of really, if you have girls, pay attention. Not that boys are less important, but there's more plumbing and things that can go wrong, if that makes sense.
I'm not sure there's more. It's just different.
Different.
So, right. And so girls and boys have the same number of hormones, but we are worried, and in Chapter 9 we talk about this, the ways in which the timing of puberty in girls is being affected by environmental exposures and also by the growing obesity epidemic among kids. Boys also are very hormonally sensitive, but what we worry about in boys is not is more about the chemicals that their mothers were exposed to during pregnancy. We know that there's something called testicular dysgenesis syndrome in boys, which means that we're feminizing the male genitalia tract by exposing their mothers during pregnancy to endocrine disrupting, hormone disrupting chemicals, especially those that interfere with testosterone. So whether you have boys or girls, the phenomenon of endocrine disruption should be on your radar screen. It's one of those things to pay attention to the same way we have to pay attention to, you know, car seat recalls or vaccination schedules. It's one more thing on our parental radar screen. My job as a biologist in this moment is to get endocrine disrupting chemicals out of our economy, redesign products so parents don't have to worry about this stuff.
What a note to end on. We'll be right back. Hold that thought. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more. We want to talk about fracking. Please stay here with me.
Go deep underwater without getting wet. Study bugs like a real scientist. Make your shadow move in colors. These are just three reasons to visit the exciting hands-on new exhibits at the Children's Museum Tucson, the region's only museum just for kids. For 25 years, we've ignited kids' imaginations at the Children's Museum Tucson. That's something to celebrate. And admission is only $2 on the first Sunday and on the 25th of each month this whole year. Children's Museum Tucson, where imagination and learning connect.
Hi there, this is Mrs. Green. Did you know that the 2012 VW Beetle has been completely redesigned, that it has exciting new features, look, and performance, and that it is one of Oprah's best things for 2012? The best news is Chapman VW has them in stock. Check out the new Beetle at Chapman VW at 4600 East 22nd Street between Columbus and Swan, or visit them at TucsonVW.com. Be sure to tell them that Mrs. Green sent you.
What if you had simple and easy solutions to live, work, and play green? Green Living Magazine, the premier green lifestyle magazine, brings you the latest in organic cooking, gardening, health and wellness, chef and celebrity interviews, as well as easy solutions to green up your everyday life. Visit greenlivingaz.com for the latest in green news. Buy your subscription and view our network videos. Find us on Facebook and Twitter, and again at greenlivingaz.com.
Can academic research really save the planet? This year, the University of Arizona took full ownership of Biosphere 2. With five ecosystems enclosed in over 7 million cubic feet of sealed glass, Biosphere 2 is a premier facility for environmental research, where the top minds in the world will come together to address some of humanity's greatest challenges, such as climate change. Now that's using your brains. The University of Arizona. Big questions, bold solutions, better tomorrows.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think, we just want you to. And if you are alive and listening to this, I am guaranteeing there's some thinking going on because of the incredibly exciting and stimulating conversation brought to us by Sandra Steingraber. Mother author, she wrote the book Raising Elijah, Protecting Our Children in an Age of Environmental Crisis. She also wrote the book Living Downstream and all that that means. It's not a good place to live, trust me. And we were talking about endocrine disruptors. And Sandra, here's the dilemma for me. I didn't get through half a page of my questions, and I knew this was going to happen, but I think we, if it's okay with you, we should really shift to the conversation on fracking. I really think it's important that there are people that I, you know, I talk about fracking. I've written about fracking. I do blogs about fracking. They say, "What is fracking?" And so I always go, like, okay, let's start there, because not everybody's the same interest level as I am. So talk about what hydrofracking is and why you see it as the number one threat to our country in terms of the environment right now.
I do, and I consider it the number one public health threat, emerging environmental health threat to our children. So that became the final chapter of Raising Elijah, so I would refer readers to that, listeners to that who want more information. Essentially, what fracking is a form of energy extraction that blows apart the bedrock beneath our feet allow the bubbles of methane that are trapped inside to flow up a borehole in a gas well. And up until a few years ago, those bubbles were thought to be not accessible. They weren't profitable to extract. And because we were running out of natural gas, investment dollars were being poured into renewable energy like solar and wind, which was very good because those don't add carbon to our planet and threaten to tank our climate system. And they also, of course, don't create toxic chemicals like combustion byproducts that we know are carcinogens and cause asthma and preterm birth and so forth in our children. But now that fracking came along and it combined with horizontal drilling, we can get all these new hydrocarbons out of the ground. It's a disincentive for renewable energy. It's sucking capital investment dollars away from renewables and to a really toxic and dangerous form of energy extraction. So here it is. A lot of us in 31 states of the United States live above a layer of bedrock that used to be an ocean floor. And if it was laid down around 400 million years ago when there was less oxygen in the water than there is now, creatures that lived in those oceans, when they died, didn't decompose. Instead, their bodies turned into bubbles of methane. And so these were trapped like a fizz of champagne bubbles in this layer of shale. And so they remained for 400 million years. The newest technology of fracking combined with horizontal drilling means you can go down, drill down a mile down to that bedrock, and then turn the drill bit sideways and, like a robotic mole, go horizontally through the bedrock, put some explosives down there, blow up the rock, and then use water, our precious fresh water, 2 to 8 million gallons per well, and sand and chemicals to blast apart those shards and hold the shards apart. That's what the sand grains are for, to hold them, like holding the door open, so that the bubbles of methane can flow up the borehole. Now, when you do that, it's not just gas that comes up the hole. It's also all the water that you put down mixed with all the chemicals and all the toxic chemicals that were trapped in the shale that now you've liberated. And some of that is radioactivity. Some of that is benzene, which is a carcinogen and causes birth defects. Some of that is toluene, which is a reproductive toxic and contributes to miscarriage, and so on and so on. And we don't have a plan for what to do with all this toxic flowback. You also, in order to exert that kind of energy, to frack apart the bedrock that far below, you have to exert major energy, 15,000 pounds per square inch of pressure. Lots and lots of diesel is used to do that. 1,000 different tanker trucks are required to bring all the water and all the chemicals to these wells. And you can't just do a little bit of fracking. In order to be profitable, you have to roll wells across the rural landscape. So we're talking about in New York, we're imagining 35,000 to 95,000 wells across our rural area of New York. So that's turning the earth inside out to get these bubbles of methane out of the ground. This is where, you know, New York State, very heavily settled place, third most populous state in the union. It's not like there is an away here in rural New York. So I'm talking to you from this church, and right down the road is a big rally and a protest here in Steuben County, New York. I should say that New York State is the only state in the union that has a temporary moratorium on fracking. So we are trying to convince our governor to not go forward with plans to lift that moratorium. The state of Vermont is the only state in the union that has taken the step of actually banning fracking, and Vermont in that case has followed many other nation states. France has banned fracking, Bulgaria has banned fracking, and so forth. So the more we learn about the hazards of fracking, the air pollution, the risks to water, the risks to our farmland, the more people learn about it, the more they're turning their back on it. But on the other hand, it's being promoted by the most powerful and richest industry in the world, the oil and gas industry. And we all know every time we turn on the television and we see a natural gas ad, there's a very powerful battle of narratives out there. The natural gas industry wants you to believe this is clean and green. And
it's our alternative, our nation's natural source for our energy needs. And it's a miracle. My husband and I do have TV, and it's a miracle that it still works, because the two of us, when those commercials come on, it's like we want to throw things at it, break the TV. There's probably a case to be made for that. The natural source for our energy needs. Okay, go on. I love that. It's like you're on a roll, and I'm right there with you.
All right. So, here's the threats to our children. So, when we lay out an accident-prone, explosive-prone, carcinogen-dependent industry right next to schools, right in our own, literally in our backyard. So, this is not an industry that's zoned somewhere that just sits there and does something. It is rolled out right in our communities, right where people live. It turns all of us into human subjects for an uncontrolled experiment. This is why the American Nurses Association, the New York Academy of Pediatricians, and other medical groups have called for an end to permits on new fracking operations until we need to hit the pause button until we can investigate the public health effects of this. We have some new research emerging from Pennsylvania showing that women who live near drilling and fracking operations during pregnancy have smaller babies, and of course, small for date infants, and things like prematurity put infants at risk for lifelong health problems and so forth, and disabilities. And so, this is preliminary data, but the question becomes: how much proof do you want before you do something different? And when you're a parent, you know that you don't need absolute proof of harm. When you call your kids out of the lake, when you hear the sound of distant thunder.
Right,
All you need to know is that this is an inherently
dangerous
situation.
There's the warning sign. Right.
And you are going to protect your child in advance of absolute proof. That's what we're asking for of our energy system. It's time to end this 19th century practice of getting industry out of the ground with drill bits. And it's really time to invest in what we know we have to do, whether we're worried about the ice caps or worried about our child's asthma, which is to get off of carbon altogether. That moment is arrived, and I want to take responsibility as the adult and this generation to solve the problem so that my kids don't have to solve it when they grow up. My father, at age 18, had to go off and defeat Hitler's army. Defeating global fascism was the job of his generation, and it messed him up. You know, he had what we would now call post-traumatic stress syndrome. My dad could never take a walk after dark because he feared sniper fire and things like that. But he still felt it was the most noble thing of his life, that he participated in that battle. We are in the middle of an ecological holocaust, and that's how I talk about it in Raising Elijah. And it's our job and our generation to say we need a redesign of our energy system that is carbon-free. And we need to insert ourselves into this conversation. This is the big human rights issue of our time. So had I lived in Elijah Lovejoy's time, I would like to think I would help, you know, run the Underground Railroad. Elijah Lovejoy was actually motivated in his abolitionism because he was a dad, because he had a 2-year-old and his wife was pregnant, and he saw slaves in St. Louis, slave children being sold away from their parents and pulled out of their mother's arms, and it broke his heart as a father. And so that's the kind of spirit that I think we need for our time, to say if we keep burning fossil fuels, our children will not have oxygen, which are made by plankton. Half of the oxygen in the world made by plankton, and our oceans are now in trouble. They won't have coral reefs. They won't have pollination systems. And also, they'll have asthma, and we'll have all this toxic pollution. And so it's really our job at this moment in time to solve this problem. And the good news is that we know we can do it. I mean, the best science, and I try to review this and bring some plain-spoken English to this in Raising Elijah, the best science shows us we could get off of fossil fuels entirely and run our economy entirely on renewables if we could bring our energy consumption down by half. And we know through advances in architecture and things that the Europeans are already doing that this is a possibility. And if it's a possibility, I argue as a parent, we have a moral obligation to go down that path and to close the door on fracking. So when I was one of the lucky recipients last year of a Heinz Award for my research and writing on environmental health, and Raising Elijah was part of the the reason for the award, I'm proud to say. It came with a $100,000 cash prize, and I just made the decision to donate that money to the anti-fracking movement of New York. I couldn't think of a better investment for my money than to stop fracking in New York. And so that donation then became the seed money for what has become a mighty coalition called New Yorkers Against Fracking. You can find that on the web. We now have close to 200 member groups and 1,000 different businesses in New York, and we are the voice for a fracking ban in the state of New York. And so I am kind of the science advisor to these different groups. And today we have all come to Painted Post, New York, where I'm speaking to you now from in Steuben County, because these people in this village are being harmed by their drinking water aquifer. The water is being sold for fracking operations south of the border in Pennsylvania, and the trains roll through their community all night long and are waking children up and ruining the peace and quiet of the neighborhood. And this is in advance of fracking even getting started in New York. So we're trying to tell our Governor Cuomo that we want him to be a champion for renewable, sustainable energy, and we have a lot of ideas to offer him if he decides to turn his back on fracking.
And there's so many things that are in this conversation about when you talked about the money, the hundreds of billions of dollars versus your $100,000. And what I want to say to people that listen to the show, that doesn't matter. That can lull us into complacency. It can paralyze us from taking action. I mean, there's a petition, a national petition, that's stopfrackingnow.com that I put up on my website. And to me, the book, your message, other people that I interview on the show, if we as citizens let our voices be heard, they will be. We can take on the oil companies. We can take on the natural gas companies, because what we have is numbers. We can outnumber them. And so I get frustrated. It's why I want my show to be on every day and have 500,000 people listening to it, because people, we have the power to change the world. And another thing you said that gets me on a rant, I don't know if people understand that at some point, and in some cases already, we are past the point of no return. In my lifetime, for certain, and I don't want to live with that. Let's prevent any more of those. You know, there are dead zones in our oceans. They're dead. There are no fish. It's not my opinion. It's science. You go there, and there's it's dead because of the toxic pollutants. The other thing is, what are they doing with the water in other places? You can't recharge it. It has toxic, above level toxins in it. What are they doing with the hundreds of millions of gallons in places that they're fracking now? What's happening to the water?
Well, great question, and we're trying to figure that out. And you're right. This is the only time in human history that humans have deliberately poisoned massive amounts of drinking water and then shoved it deep into geological strata. We've never done that before. And so two things are of consequence here and worthy of note. One is that half of the water actually stays trapped down there, and it never comes back. And so that means we have done something that no human beings have ever done before, which is we've made water disappear from the hydrologic cycle. You know, like my kids and I like to talk about how the water we drink used to be dinosaur pee, right? It's the same water that's always been, on Earth, and it's the water cycle, and it's this wheel that's forever turning. It's rain, it's groundwater, becomes our blood plasma for a while, we pee it out, it goes back into a river, it falls as rain, and on. But when you shove water that far down into the earth, it's far below the water table, and it's gone forever. So at a time when climate change is causing water to become scarce, we are turning only 1% of the world's water is in the form of fresh drinkable water, only 1%. We're taking that 1% at a time when it's becoming more and more scarce, scarcely available, and we're turning it into poison and making it disappear forever. That's one obscenity of it, right? Well, and then the other fact is that half of the water comes back.
I know.
And then we have to figure out where to dispose of it, and it's toxic. And we don't have a good solution.
And I'm sorry that we had to have a rush ending. That's what happens on a radio show. If you are willing to come back, we would love to have you back as a guest.
Thank you so much.
Okay, be in touch with us at MrsGreensWorld.com. Make it a great green week, and we'll be here again next Saturday. Sandra, thank you so very much.
My pleasure. Thanks.